Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
We're on here right now speaking about The Wire. Like, who would have ever thought? I shared this with my fans last week. Who would have ever thought 20 years later we would still be talking about it?
Hey everyone, I'm Kobe.
And I'm Dave.
And welcome to the Wire Strip Podcast. We're the podcast that goes through each episode of The Wire one by one. But you don't just hear from us. You hear from some of the cast, you hear from the crew, some of the creators, and we also hear from you guys too. So stay tuned to find out how we can hear your voice on this podcast.
Yeah, and if you want to have a chat, we're at social media, we're on all the social medias at The Wire Stripped, primarily Twitter and Instagram, or email us burner@thewirestripped.com. But without much further ado, let's get on to myself and Kobe's chat that we recorded earlier. It's about episode 12 of season 4, which is called That's Got His Own.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon, walk the straight and narrow track. When you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. Just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He got the fire and the fury.
Welcome everyone. We are now observing the training of the young pup.
Yes, we're parked outside the live exercise yard.
It's like a proper, like, I don't know, SAS training or Black Ops or SWAT.
Yeah. I was expecting some of those cardboard cutouts to just suddenly pop up, you know, somebody with a gun and then a woman with a handbag, and you're like, oh, make a decision, Michael.
Exactly. Yeah. And we didn't see that. But I mean, when you first saw this, what did you think was happening?
At no point did I think Michael was in danger. Is that, if that's what you're getting at?
Because I didn't think so either. I guess that's what they're trying to get at.
Yeah.
Because Snoop and, you know, you see someone running and you see them being chased by Snoop and
there's no
Chris
sense
Parlow.
Of threat.
But at the same time, it's like, I don't think this doesn't make sense.
Also, it's not Chris and Snoop's style to run. We've never seen them chase anybody.
That's true, actually.
Right? They just march. They basically, like, march their victims into an abandoned house.
They appear with an empty, like, plastic crate that you would go put the records in. And but that's got that's got your nail gun and your gun and or your PVC too.
Like. And you're like, follow me.
Yeah.
Come on, in here.
That's true, actually. I can't imagine them running to chase them down. That's probably why I didn't twig. That's probably why I didn't think it was happening.
Yeah, something's up. And also, they've been spending a lot of time to recruit this guy, and suddenly they're trying to kill him. So yeah, that's the start of the episode. And interesting, though, to me how just, like, I don't know how much time has passed, if any at all, but, like, Michael is suddenly, like, insane crack shot, right?
Well, yeah.
He's a quick learner, I guess.
Well, I think that's probably part of the training we haven't seen. But maybe he's not a bad shot in the first place. Maybe he's held a gun a few times before.
But how many of these training sessions has he been doing? He took down Chris and Snoop on his first one. It was good. It's kind of,
and they,
like,
seemed super happy with it.
Yeah. They were very proud. Yeah. What I really wanted, though, to follow this is, like, Empire Strikes Back style. I want Michael on, like, Chris's back.
Mm.
It'd be Chris on Michael's back. Snoop on Michael's back.
Yeah.
While he's running and doing somersaults.
Oh, right. You wanted that.
Through the vacants.
What, with Bug in the brooksack.
And her, just whispering things into his ear, like, Focus.
yes.
Is that too much to ask?
I don't think. I mean, we can ask David Simon. David, if you're listening to this, which you must be, can you reshoot the scene, please?
Yeah, please. For the special edition.
Do a George
Lucas.
The
Wire special edition. You know, go back and fix all the things that you got wrong the
exactly.
first time. Yeah.
Put,
add a load of CG in there.
Put a CGI Jabba the Hutt in there as well, for whatever reason. I think we're digressing. But yeah, it's cool. We see the young pup. He's getting some skills, which is interesting. But I think let's stick with Michael and his friends and head to the school. In the previous episode, I don't think we talked about it much, but Dookie has been fast-tracked to the high school, which is not what he needs.
No, and it's not what he's not happy about it, and neither is Prez. So Prez goes to Marcia Donnelly in this episode to try and sort of appeal to her, say he's not ready for high school. You know,
he's got the book smarts, but he hasn't got the
social skills.
Yeah,
he'll get eaten alive.
Yeah.
Plus, he's the kind of like he's needs his clique, right? Like they kind of like, as we saw in the very first episode, Boys of Summer, like they look out for him as well, as much as they kind of bully him as well. It is kind of a love-hate relationship. Mm. And I think suddenly to put him out on his own without any social circles, I think Prez correctly identifies
Prez
that
knows
as a
what's
problem.
Going on.
Yeah.
Prez knows exactly what's going on. And, mate, I'll just... The amount of times you feel sorry for Dookie whenever you see him in The Wire, this is another one. And it should be, I guess in some ways, it should be a happy day. But, mate, at 13, 14, if someone said, you're going to leave your friends behind and go to a different school, you'd be like, I don't want to.
Yeah. No, exactly. I think you're right. We'd all feel like that. And his circumstances are particularly dire.
Yeah.
And the other thing that stood out from that scene was, like, Marcia Donnelly's response to Prez about, you know, she shows how astute she is that she's realized that he's been clothing Dookie.
He's
been he's been feeding him, and she kind of says, you know, you can't adopt him, you know. She's what looks to be very like a very cynical worldview, and a bit heartless. She's actually trying to steal Prez for a career in teaching, right? For what's to come. Oh, there's plenty more kids coming.
I can understand that. He needs to have that tension for all the kids. Dookie will leave, hopefully become an adult. There'll be new kids that need his help, and hopefully he can give them the same amount of care and attention that is given to Dookie and Randy and the kids. But yeah, it's a hard... It must be hard for teachers.
You know, Jermaine, that's the little bro. You know, he's like big as shit now.
This is the voice of Nathan Corbett, who played Donut.
That's the little bro, and he's like the kindest person you would meet. And it's funny watching him shoot Dookie, because he was always fresh as shit. Like, Jermaine was always like that one of the iciest cats you meet. Like, and so when he would transform into Dookie, you know, it just was amazing. It speaks on, you know, him as a thespian, you know, and him as a professional.
If I'm a police officer and I'm working for my pension, you know, and I'm just trying to get to that pension, because that's, you know, whenever you see any sort of police drama or thing, it's like, it's always about the pension, you know, and understandably so, you're putting your life on the line.
This is Jennifer Wood. She's the editor of Mental Floss.
You do get sort of pushed into like this place where like, okay, so I go in here trying to make a difference, and now I just want to get through it. I want to survive. I want to like make my existence as easy on me as possible, because who has the energy to like keep fighting a system that where everyone is pretty much against you for, you know, 20 years, 10 years. Like, you can imagine, you know, if they brought The Wire back today, you can sort of see Prez just being another one of those like by the numbers, you know, probably has his own kids now. It's like he's got that stuff at home, and those kids, you know, in the school he just wants to get them the basic thing that they need to move on, you know. I think it would happen to the person who wouldn't be browbeaten.
Prez is trying to outsmart the system.
This is our good friend and contributor, Baltimorean Andrew Johnston.
He thinks that this singular act of charity, like it is in not singular, individual act of charity is going to matter. And I have found this, and I probably did the same thing if I really sat and thought about it when I first started teaching. And you see the couple of troubled students that you could I could really help if I just had some extra office hours and like took them out for a meal or something like that, you know. But ultimately, you are a limited resource. Each of us is a limited resource, right? We only have so many hours in a day. We only have so much money to give. And like this, sharing your means with this one individual is not, it's kind of the flaw in charity in general. Like, I'm not saying anyone should not give to charity. Charity is a perfectly reasonable thing in the system we live in. But in the system we live in, charity is just woefully insufficient. You know, if you count up all the privately funded food banks and homeless shelters and all of these charities, and you weigh it against the impact of poverty, it's crystal clear that poverty is winning that struggle. And so again, Prez thinks that he's going to operate outside of the system, and that's going to allow him to have this great impact he's looking for. And it's not. Like, the system has to change.
I have such respect for teachers, and I've a huge respect for all of our listeners who are teachers. Because it's a hard job, but it's such an important job. It's one that's undervalued by society.
Yeah, 100%.
One of the things this season is telling us very clearly, $53 million deficit. And in the budget, and it's one I couldn't do, and I think it takes a real type of person and a lot of courage as well.
Yeah, I considered it for like a split second to be a teacher, and I couldn't do it. And so it's much kudos to anyone who could do it.
They'd walk all over us, Kobe.
No, absolutely. Prez here, also Prez is looking after a few kids here. He goes over to check on Randy at Miss Anna's house, and using a bit more of his police wiles, he has a chat with those guys, and then sees the kind of unmarked car that the Carver and the team had helped set up outside Randy's place.
Yeah,
just to say, okay, things are looking good, I'm kind of happy here.
But he, even in this moment, Prez looks kind of dubious.
Yeah,
doesn't he? Like, it's interesting how Prez's faith in the police as an institution has been shaken now, as has Randy's, because we see the cold reception that Randy gives Carver when Carver then later shows up at his house. You know, his foster mother gives him a very warm reception, invites him in for breakfast and a meal, but Randy's not impressed. Which ultimately then leads to that heartbreaking final scene in this episode. So as you'll all know, Randy's home gets horribly firebombed in one of the most vicious attacks in The Wire.
I object to this. I'm so disappointed.
You're anti-fire. I am anti-firebombing.
I am anti-firebombing.
It's a staunch position.
But the setup for that was someone rang the police and said, "Like policeman down."
Yeah, shots fired nearby, right?
Yeah, exactly. And they leave. And
surely there's a protocol in place to prevent this exact type of thing.
Exactly.
If you're trying to protect somebody.
I would have thought that would be the first thing they do. Can you just check if there's actually anyone there that actually needs attention, first of all? And I'm so angry about it, but obviously what transpires is that, it's firebombed, and we see the outpouring of that next episode.
Mm.
But it's not a good scene when you finish the episode with a Molotov cocktail into a house.
And that scene in the hospital, they show you very little of the actual drama of that, which I think makes it more horrifying, right? Just because they cut from the fire bombing to the next time we cut to this plot is in the hospital and Carver's visiting, and you know, we just get that glimpse on the wall, him clocking the names on the wall, and then going to see Randy, and Randy, again, just, it's that exacerbated cold treatment. Like, are you really going to help? Are you going to look out for me? Detective Carver, yeah, you're going to look out for me in that sort of like jaded, cynical way, and you can't blame him. It's really tragic.
He knows what's going to happen to him before we do, which is horrible.
But I got, you know, hats off to Joe Chappelle, who directed this episode, and the team, because that closing shot of Carver walking down that hospital corridor is like really haunting and absolutely, just really well done.
I'm going to talk to social services. We'll get you some help. Randy. You gonna help, huh? You gonna look out for me? You gonna look out for me, Sergeant Carver? You mean it? You gonna look out for me? You promise? You got my back, huh?
My favorite scene is for sure, and I'm sure you could guess, but it's definitely the one with me and Sergeant Carver in the hospital.
You're listening to Maestro Harrell, who played Randy Wagstaff.
I don't know exactly what I was thinking when I shot that. You know what I mean? But I do know I got the achieved result I wanted. And I do know that, like, I don't know. It's just weird because it's it's just when you have stuff like that, especially with, like, something that's that emotional at that age, I just feel like, looking back on it, it's just like, man, like, even when I watch myself in other things too, though, you kind of be like, man, like, who was that 15, 16 year old kid? Like, you were like, what did I, when I was done with that scene, what did I immediately care about? See what I mean? Like, what was it? Was it the next Xbox 360 game? Was the next 2K about to come? I don't know. But it's just, I will say though, but that, like, A, I love that scene because it's so iconic for the show, and I'm grateful for that. But then two, yeah, I just feel like watching it, I just see this, like, yeah, I just see this kid who I'm like, man, even now I watch it, I just go like, man, like, yeah, you gotta keep doing this shit. Like, I believe you. And I don't get me wrong, I'm hard on myself because I'll rewatch stuff and be like, yeah, I don't, That ain't my best. You saw that? Yeah, it's all right. Like, I'm really hard on myself. So it's like, since I'm seeing that, it's just like, yeah. And also, I think I like that one so much too, because I know, like I said, this happened to somebody. So whether that person ever sees it, whether there's somebody else, because there will be more who go through it. Like, it's not going to stop, you know? But yeah, it's like, to you know, if they feel, it's been a thing that I've always been told about, so hopefully this is true.
He trusted Carver, and there's a very painful scene in which he says, you know, to Carver, oh, you got my back? Oh, you gonna take care of me? I see what that looks like, because Carver had let him down. And Carver, to his credit, was devastated.
This is Kristen Henning. She's the director of the Georgetown Juvenile Justice Initiative, and she's also the author of Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth.
That's what kids see. It's really hard for Black children in America to develop a trusting relationship with police. And that's just one sort of example, anecdotal example almost, of how that those kinds of relationships deteriorate. But they didn't take care of him with the level of attention that they needed.
I guess sticking with Prez. Prez is all over this episode. Not Prez. But I guess in the schools, we're seeing the tests that they've been trying to duke the stats for. They've been training the kids for.
They should have had Dookie do it. Dookie's Jukes.
did he take the test before he left? I can't remember.
Oh God, I don't know. He always just seemed to be on that computer.
Did
he do any work?
I would have loved to have taken tests to play on the computer.
He got to go up to high school, so he's just been doing something.
But we see the tests happening. No one seems happy about it. You see the kind of, it's a different, well, you see Prez's class, and you see Buddy Colvin's class taking the tests. Naaman seems to be doing all right. Zenobi seems to be doing all right. I can't remember the other kids that went to the restaurant.
Albert and Little
Albert. I can't remember how he was doing. But the guy that went to the restaurant with him, yeah. I can't remember his name. But
the listeners are screaming at us.
Yeah.
Never mind the listeners screaming at you. Producer Tom is screaming at you. It's Darnell Tyson, played by Devon Cooper.
I'm sorry, guys. We don't have an encyclopedic knowledge.
He doesn't. He's not a fan of it. He's not a fan of the tests.
No. And neither is Bunny or Dr. Parenti. Yeah. You know, they kind of, you know.
Bunny, Prez, Dr. Parenti are all pissed off. Mr. Kett is not happy with what's going on. It's just like, well, we have to do this because our hand's been forced.
Nobody wants to do these tests except the institution itself.
Yeah.
Which is $53 million in deficit.
The whole institution, not just Tilghman High School, the whole
the whole bloody thing. System. Yeah.
$53 million. But
the same issues kind of exist here in the UK with this whole idea of, you know, it just being completely stats driven and results driven. I think that drives a lot of the a lot of the wrong focus in the education system. Yeah, well,
I didn't grow up with the SAT system, which they have now. And I kind of fear for that kind of stress. Obviously, there's been generations that have gone through that now since I left school and went through the school system. But, you know, the stress of exams is real. And to have, like, young kids doing it and, like, pressure from the parents, because there will be pressure from the parents. And it's like, it just seems unfair.
And the schools are ranked here, right?
So by that.
Ofsted, isn't it? Yeah, Ofsted, kind of stuff. Yeah.
So they're ranked by this, how kids perform. And I think a lot of people realise that how you perform on a test doesn't necessarily represent your intelligence or your capability in life afterwards. It's how you know how to do a test.
It also creates an incredible amount of stress for the individual, right? I mean, like, I still wake up having nightmares. The only recurring nightmare I have is literally I have to sit my, it was called the Leaving Cert in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
So the equivalent of the A levels, I guess, or I don't know what it is in America, but the, I have to sit it again because whatever happened 20 years ago, there was a mistake and now I have to do it again and I don't remember anything. And it's horrifying. I wake up with the sweats, man. Terrifying.
So we're on Prez's side. We're on Bunny's side. We're on Mr. Kett's side. We're on Dr.
And Prince's we're on the side of the students.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Ban all tests.
Some other kind of, you know, qualification, but yeah.
Well, continuous assessment is a better model, or those kind of things, right?
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Did we just fix the system?
I think we did.
That is a real thing, and it really doesn't serve anyone's interests. Exams are consistently shown to not be a good way to actually measure whether or not students have met learning objective. Exam anxiety is a serious issue that I've seen studies that show it impacts as much as 30% of students, more than one letter grade. Like, that is huge. It skews all of the results. Like, you have to throw those results out because a third of the students lost a letter grade because they're nervous. That's not measuring anything. And one of the most significant factors for success on one of these exams is whether or not you had breakfast that morning, you know, which if you're Duquan, you know, you didn't, unless Prez brought you an apple or something. Like, that didn't happen. You go like, well, okay, well then how are we tying school budgets to these exams? It doesn't make any sense, and the show knows it doesn't make any sense. And it seems like a lot of my friends who've watched it have been like, especially here in the UK, go, well, they really exaggerated that, right? Because like, they're just trying to point out that the testing is ridiculous. And I was like, they didn't have to. They just went to a school meeting and took some notes, transcribed the meeting, and then came over and gave everyone a script. Because it is scary how real that is. And it really does come down to, just like they're juking the stats in the, which Prez says, they're juking the stats in the police, they're juking the stats in the school, they're juking the stats on the streets, they're doing it everywhere. And it hasn't gotten better.
Right, so in the last episode, we had that amazing moment where Freeman discovered a tomb. He became a tomb raider. Now that's something I'd watch.
Right? Lester Freeman Tomb Raider.
Yeah, I would watch that.
I would watch 100%.
He could be like one of Lara Croft's like eccentric uncle.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I love it. That should be the next iteration. Because there's not been any good Lara Croft film. I didn't see the last one. It's probably better. Although Dominic West was in the last one.
That was all right. Oh, he was? Oh my God, full circle.
Yeah.
You know, all the pieces matter. So Freeman found a tomb. He found all the bodies. Mm-hmm. And that's where we left things. Now enter Jay Landsman.
And not just enter Jay Landsman. So they're in the Bacons.
Charge in.
Jay Landsman drives, I don't know how far to get there, to tell Freeman off to stop finding
he's
the fucking
not
bodies.
Happy. No, not he's got all. A clearance rate, man. You know, we talk about juking the stats. He lives by the stats.
Fuck the stats.
Landsman loves his stats. And you do not mess with the clearance rate. If there's one thing we know about the Homicide Department,
yeah.
And if there's one thing that David Simon and Ed Burns learned about their time at the Homicide Department,
Mike,
the board is king.
We've seen this before when McNulty...
Oh, in season two?
In season two, yeah. got all the bodies in the can. No one was happy with them. Least of all, Jay Landsman. In this one, the press... The fact that Freeman's uncovered the tip of the iceberg and suggests there's going to be 20 more... Yeah,
at least.
...is enough to get Jay Landsman to leave his desk, leave his porn, leave his coffee.
Yeah. It is weird. It's jarring seeing him outdoors, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I would agree that the point of the character and who I think he might be is the fellow who goes along to get along.
This is the absolutely incredible voice of Delaney Williams, who played Jay Landsman.
But as opposed to a nefarious action that he might take, it would be, we have a certain quota. And we have to meet that quota. Once we get that quota, then you can go off on your own and have your thing. But if you're going to screw with what I have to get done, then you're fucking with my my life and my income. And at the same time, we are solving murders, but we're not going out there looking for murders. I think he says that more than once. And I know he says it to Clark and Wendell, to Bunk and Freeman, when they're finding the bodies in the Vacants. And I think it's one of the important descriptors that they put in the show, about bureaucracy, about large institutions, and the mental managers who make them run, who make them work, and create that another level of, I don't know, more politics and more agendas to go through to solve whatever issue you started trying to solve the first place when you formed a police force. And you aren't really doing that good a job of anymore, because as part of that is these levels that exist and the people that have to live in them.
And it shows you how much things have changed,
yeah,
in The Wire within one season, right? Because at the beginning of this, we had, you know, it would have been Freeman going into, well, Rawls would still be involved, but Rawls to Burrell to Royce. You think those,
that would be the,
you think
yeah,
that
would be the
same chain of command would, yeah, have opened up the Vacants? I don't know.
I don't think it would. But
or they'd been slower about it.
There would have been, the way Daniels learns how to play the game even more from his side of things, where he goes to Rawls and said, you know, let's get the bodies on this side of the year, so it's in, yeah, the previous
attributable to there, yeah. Daniels is good because he is moralistic and wants to do the right thing, just like Freeman, and help his buddy Freeman out while also, as you say, being able to navigate the game, right? So he can manage upwards and downwards very
absolutely
effectively.
Yeah, because the stats he knows will be a massive concern for the higher ups, but at the same time he's like, we need to make sure you're doing it right.
And what's interesting, I think, about this is when Rawls brings that to Carchetti with the same message, Carchetti is still in this very green idealistic phase of his mayor, isn't he? Because he's kind of offended.
Oh, how that will fall.
Like offended, isn't he, at the beginning by what Rawls says. Like this bodies, man, you got to open up those bodies. What are you talking about? But then he also says, but yeah, also it'd be nice to get the stats for Royce.
He's starting to learn. But this is great. I mean, the band's coming back together again. We get the guys back in the MCU. Sydney's there.
Yes, we get that great scene where Marimo is walking out with his box.
Off you fuck, my friend.
Oh my God, so satisfying. And there's that lovely moment where Herc says, you know, Marimo leaves and Herc turns to Freeman and he says, look, is it okay if like we just make it look like the orders are coming from me because I'm a sergeant? You're just like, see if
Freeman doesn't give a shit. He's like, mate, do what you need to do to get your thrills.
Sometimes life just gives you a moment, huh?
He was gonna do me, and instead he gets done. I'm dipped in shit here. I'm the luckiest motherfucker you know.
Gentlemen, the target is still Mr. Stanfield. And from the look of things, we're no closer to him than when I left here 2 months ago. Now, they might not let me go after murders, but they cannot stop me from chasing the drugs. Leander, I want you surveilling his people. See if they're still up on cell phone. How are you with the paper trail?
Okay.
I want you down at the city assessment office, pulling paper on all the purchases on the west side over 100,000. Then get down to MVA and check a luxury cars in his name, all right? Now, this boy has been in the game for a while now. He might try to launder money. Herc, I want you on the paperwork re-requisitioning the wiretap equipment that Marimo shipped on down to ISD. We're gonna need all of that to get back up. Okay? If anyone needs me, I'm down at Missing Persons. All right? Let's go.
Lester.
Yeah.
Well, this is cool.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think you could do so that the direction comes from me? I mean, I am the sergeant here.
And as per Daniels' word, Freeman has got to pick his MCU commander.
Yeah.
And he has chosen wisely. He chose Beach House man himself. Asher, I think is his name, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great. He comes back in. First thing he says is, how's the Beach House going? Great. Get in there.
My friend.
Doesn't give a shit. Herc's like, who the fuck's that? The best commander in the whole of the district.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kima doesn't come back.
No, she seems so. Well, we see you see Freeman sort of go to her, right? Mm-hmm. He's about to give her the offer, but he kind of tests her first. Like, are you liking it here? And she seems happy. She literally is like legs up on the desk, like down the phone, talking about some booty call she's doing.
Well, she's getting her extra pay, isn't she? She's paying off her baby mama for the child support.
Yeah.
So I think she's in a good place, and Lester seen it. I mean, if Lester was any other cop, he could be going out that chain of command, but he suits himself right to the ground where he's at. He's happy as all the pigs and all the shit now.
He just wants to get the job done.
He does.
Yeah.
And well.
And then we get that other great scene with Freeman, Bunk and McNulty in the bar. Like, absolute legends.
Bunk and McNulty in the bar is always great, but when Freeman's there, it always adds like an extra layer of like,
this class. They're quite a triple bill.
They are.
Of all the characters in The Wire, they're the ones you'd love to just go on for a night out
absolutely
with.
Absolutely.
Crazy.
As long as they didn't go to Orlando's bar.
Or as long as you don't end up in a vacant looking for a body, as in what happens in this episode.
How is that ever a bet that you can...
I love that. But Freeman makes a bet that if we walk into any vacant with this nail, we'll find a body. And lo and behold, they do. Do they call it in? No, because they're not allowed. Because Landsman said no. It's such a mental situation when you think about it.
I think the thing to finish off here in the major crimes is that all of all of Herc's dalliances and jackassery, as we talked about in previous episodes, kind of comes to a head.
Yes.
The internal affairs, like, something's wrong here, mate. We need Herc and we need Sidney. We need
Dozerman.
And Herc, to his credit, says, no, you don't need me. You don't need those guys. You just need me. I can vouch for them. And
you got to give it to Herc in that instance. Yeah, absolutely. As much of a tit and as hateable as he is for his actions to Bubbles, to Randy, you know, he's a fuck up, but he's got some level of a code, right? He's not going to bring his friends down with
him. This is the thing. Yeah, that's where his code lies, and that's why him and Herc in the early season Carver. Were so great. Yeah. Sorry. That's why him and Carver were so great together, because they had each other's backs. Herc has everyone's back in this, in the force, 100%. I do not doubt that for one second.
Yeah.
That he's got their backs.
And he was trying to do the right thing. Like, he was trying to take down Marlowe
in his own way. Yeah.
His own incompetent way.
His own face-palming way.
Yeah.
Oh, Herc. This is his season. This is Herc's season. Of all the seasons where we have Herc, this is where... Because he does it all. He catches the mayor having sex. He loses the camera. He doesn't protect Randy. He doesn't protect Bubbles. And both of those things come back and bite everyone in the... Like, everyone gets bit by those in some way, shape, or form. You know, like, Herc becomes... he becomes like the I don't know what you would call it. I forget the term. He's like the lightning rod for chaos this season. Yeah, he is at the center. He's in the eye of the storm of all the really bad stuff that happens this season. And the crazy, like, no one man has been more influential in the city of Baltimore than Herc's character is this season. And you're just like, my God. It's just a nonstop.
Just a quick stop by what Carchetti's up to. Trying to find $54 million, essentially.
Yeah, so this is the big issue of this episode, isn't it? And they decide that they're going to have to go to the governor.
Yeah,
for support, right, is a Republican governor. And we see this sort of scene of the Carchetti and Norman just sitting outside in this grand location. It's Christmas, apparently,
yeah,
which we've just discovered.
This episode and next episode are as close as you get to a Christmas special. Yeah. Why?
Not at all Christmassy, no. Except for this moment. And they're getting dicked around, right?
Yeah.
They're clearly, it's a power play.
It is.
Right. Knew he was on a call.
And it's only when they leave to go home after hours presumably spent there that the governor's ready to take them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, as they're walking out the door.
Mm.
So it's a total play. And then we kind of finish, well, this is all going to accumulate in next episode, but this final scene on this plot is them all around the council chambers, and they're kind of assessing their options. And it's kind of laid out to Carchetti as you either take the money and then you lose your shot in 2 years at governor, because mm-hmm. he'll bring that up and the DC voters will be like, well,
we had to bail you out. You're rubbish.
Yeah. But you save the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Or you don't do that and you get your shot at governorship in 2 years, but and you kind of help the teachers, right? That was the kind of two options.
Yeah. Well, which way does he decide? We'll find out next episode. Stay tuned, guys.
There were a couple of great lines from Norman I'd like to call out.
Sure, this, of course.
Reggie Cathy is so good. He says, he sums it up as, so we take the state money and our schools go from being fucked up and broke to just being fucked up. The other one I liked was, Carchetti asked, how in Christ's name do you lose $54 million? And Norman, so cool, he just goes, 1 million at a time.
But I don't know the setup of the states. Of each state in the United States, but you kind of think, help them out without having to eat. Just help them out. Obviously, put caveats there.
I know, but the problem is, it's an individual. Like it's ultimately, it's two people's egos going up against each other, right? It's the Republican governor and Carchetti having literally just playing games with each other.
If only could just
in a waiting room, right?
If it could remove egos, from, I mean, yeah, if it could just remove egos from politics,
wouldn't that be nice?
It would be plain sailing.
Let me say this: so not only are we not investing enough in schools. And when I talk about investing in schools in ways that allow for smaller class sizes so that teachers can actually, you know, do their jobs, having, you know, assistance for teachers, you know, a behavioral aide who's not a police officer, who's not a law, you know, a law enforcement official, who's not going to, you know, take a punitive or disciplinary or exclusionary response to the child, but just work one-on-one, right, with young people who need help. You know, investing in resources for mental health services, for special education resources for children who have additional needs. So yes, we see that across the country is that some schools, period, just don't have enough resources. And then when they do have the resources, we're allocating the resources within schools the wrong way. So we're allocating resources. The budgets for police in schools is ginormous in many schools. And there's a whole report by the ACLU called Cops and No Counselors. It's a beautiful report by the American Civil Liberties Union, if any of your listeners want to read more. And it literally goes like, you know, city by city or, you know, school district by school district, and talks about the number of officers that schools have in comparison to the number of mental health providers. And it's just the disproportionality, our misalignment of resources and priorities is just so skewed in our country. So we're investing wrong.
What's going on with Naaman? Because this is a
breaking point for Naaman episode, isn't it?
It's a bit of a tit this season, this episode.
This all kicks off when Kennard, is it Kennard or Kennard?
Kennard.
Kennard. Kennard tells Naaman that the package got the police raided his stash, right? They kicked in the door. Mm-hmm. And Naaman's like, oh, shit, that sucks. Okay, great. And then tells Michael. Michael has to point out to Naaman that Kennard probably took it, you know. And this, again, we see Michael street smarts. He says, go and, you know, check the door. Did the door get busted down? Any signs of the locks being broken? Well,
is it street smarts, or he's been taught by the best? We've seen him in his Black Ops training.
Yeah, you're right.
So Chris and Snoop, and they've probably taught him the nail gun trick by this point. If you want to bury people, use these nail guns.
Yeah.
He knows all about doors.
It's got to be this type.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. You're right. Yeah. He's nails and doors. He got the basic DIY training. And then we get that brutal, brutal scene where Michael goes to confront Kennard with Naaman.
And we should just reiterate the difference in size between Naaman and Kennard and the ferocity.
He's a child. Like, yes. He's an actual, I mean, they're all children as such, but Kennard is a tiny, tiny child.
He is.
Yeah.
But the ferocity that he has, like
he's brilliant.
When
I stuck your package up my ass, that's where it is.
When Kennard is the same age as Naaman, he will be one of the most fearsome people on the planet.
100%.
That scene when we were shooting that, first of all, it was cold as hell, sir. That's the first thing.
This is Tuliso Dingwall. He played Kennard on The Wire.
Tuliso, my man Tuliso. My man Tuliso, he played Kennard. That's my man. Shout out to Tuliso. Oh my goodness, how could I ever forget the little bro, man? He's the man.
It was cold as hell. We hadn't eaten for like a legit, I want to say 6 hours or so, but we were shooting outside and it was interesting to do because they were trying to get different camera angles and things like that, but we had been shooting for several hours that scene, and it was cold. Great night though, and my dad got pissed because we had not eaten for several hours, which is why I have the memory outside of the actual scene. But it was a great scene to shoot. The timing for the punches was all timing. Everybody always asks, did I really get hit, and I always tell them no. I didn't really get hit. The blood tastes like a weird strawberry soury syrup stuff. And my knocked out teeth were little pieces of chiclet gum. Like, if you guys ever notice it, when I'm laying on the ground there and you see my teeth, like the teeth, I swear to God, it was gum. And that strawberry, like, the blood those tastes like strawberry. It's like sour strawberry something. But it's edible, but it's not something you want to keep in your mouth for a whole long time. But yeah, it was, that scene was definitely fun to shoot. Good pizza afterwards. And again, just a fun moment with Julito.
This is his breaking point, right? When he sees what Michael unleashes on Kenar. I think this is the first point that Naimond has realized what the game is, or the dark side of the game, right? Because he's been treating it as a game,
yes,
as such, or just something, you know, his mother wants him to do.
And also, I think the benefit of Buddy Colvin over the season teaching him how to do things as well. I think he must have had that influence from Bunny and those guys. Yeah,
softened him a bit. But like for me, I think that it's so beautifully acted here as well, where he's backing away and he's just says, "I don't want it. I don't want it." It really broke my heart. I'm writing my notes for this episode. A lot of my notes, looking back at them, were just the crying face emoji.
Why am I laughing?
No, not that one. It's so funny. It's just so sad. But what it then translates to, those emotions, is kind of bravado. So he goes to the gym and starts picking on Dookie to try and he says the same line, right? And Michael picks up, he says the same line that Kennard had said to him, I think, and Michael picks up on it and Michael steps in. It's funny, you don't know who to, because Michael's gone so dark here,
yeah,
but also and Naaman's being a dick to Dookie, so you're like, stand up for him, but also Michael is terrifying and you feel bad for Naaman. It's like you just feel bad for everyone really here.
I reckon, like, Naaman ran home last night, the night before, and just said, "Right, I need to get my edge back." And
yeah, he's an easy target.
Yeah, who's the easiest target? Dookie.
One of my all-time favorites is D'Angelo saying with his mom, and he's saying, "You raised me into this, and now you gotta let me do me." And he basically tells her that he can't do it anymore.
This is, of course, the one and only Naaman, played brilliantly by Julito McCollum.
And I always think of that scene, and it's this rewatch that I've been doing, where I'm noticing how that correlates to my episode, my season, and my character having that moment with Carver, and I believe it was Cuddy in the gym, and it was just perfect, man. It's just perfect writing, dude. Like, it's a really well written show, and you don't get TV like this anymore, man. You just don't.
But Dookie's kind of nonplussed, Michael's gone. He's turned the corner now, where he's just like, I can't be dealing with this.
Yeah,
you're a pussy, for want of a better turn of phrase. And I don't know. Michael just saw like the red mist at that point.
Yeah. So, and then Cuddy, he kicks him out of the gym, right?
Yeah.
And then, an interesting chain of events is about to kick off. I mean, so Cuddy calls Carver for help, you know, Cuddy to help with Naaman, and they kind of figure out what's happening. Then Cuddy goes to appeal to Michael. And this is kind of another break. This is a turning point where things could go either way for Michael, you kind of feel. And Cuddy's really putting himself on the line here, while also we get that a glimpse of that hard ass soldier that Cuddy used to be, right?
Oh, mate.
Where he doesn't even blink or look, address the monk, isn't it, the guy?
Yeah.
But he pays for it with a kneecapping, right?
Well, a shot, a shot to knee. Bunny's not Bunny, sorry, Cuddy is fearsome. And this, I love the way he has turned away from the game, and I love the way he knows still what he could be. He knows the kind of person he used to be, but he's so happy, like, now, protecting these kids, looking out for them, looking out for himself as well.
He lives in both worlds quite comfortably.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then there's that tragic line where, you know, Michael stops, says, "I'll call you an ambulance," because Michael's still such a good kid. And he says, "No, go be with your people." This is like Cuddy.
He knows. He knows if Michael doesn't go and join them, then he's going to be
in more trouble.
He's going to be in more trouble. Yeah. He knows. He does know the game. and he knew how to get out of it as well.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's actually really interesting. He knew how to get out of the game.
Yeah.
Just say, trying to get the hell out of here. Let's not double down on this.
This is, of course, the man himself, Chad Coleman, who played Cutty on The Wire.
But I also know you didn't have to be a knee. It could have been a different part of the body, and that would have been a done deal. And I do understand the abject violence. I understand them. I used to do that. I lived it. So I understood it. But that's what I'm saying. That compassionate heart, especially in the hood, when you're able to find it and you're able to demonstrate that, no matter how they act in your face, trust me, that's a powerful thing. So, yes, even in that critical moment, he understood he didn't want them to be any more of a victim than they already were, you know. And to me, on a certain level, as I said, he did spare my life. He did. That was a warning. Don't, you know, one of the lines I like, and I know it has nothing to do with this, is I told you about playing them away games. Well, that's how that related to Cutty. Don't leave that gym. These streets ain't for you, bro. They gonna come to you. If they don't come to you, don't you come out here. Because you ain't ready for this, and I understand that. And conversely, I understood it from the political side with Stringer Bell and you know, Barksdale telling. That was one of my favorite scenes, too. He said, I told you about playing the away games.
Right, why don't we check in with Bubbles?
Oh, I don't want to check in with Bubbles.
This is a tough one. This is a tough old plot. So Bubbles is shopping around for some chemicals.
Why am I laughing?
I don't know. I know sometimes exactly. You have to laugh. It's so dark. So Bubbles, we're in a sort of yard.
Where does he go? I need to buy some killing chemicals. Where do I go, please?
Well, there's a fountain of knowledge which Bubbles taps into, like a horrifying fountain of knowledge. Like everyone knew there was like, what about rat poison? No, that's not going to do the job. What you want is sodium cyanide.
Yeah,
you want to slip just the right amount. And I think the other horrifying thing here was how confidently and assuredly, I don't know if we got any of the names of the other characters here, but they, you know, and that one guy says to Bubbles, like, don't worry about the police. They're not going to come looking. They're not going to investigate. Because this guy's going to be essentially like a nothing to the police, which is so horribly sad.
Well, yeah, they're not going to test for cyanide. They're going to test for drugs in the system and come to the conclusion that it was an overdose.
Yeah.
And that's well, fine. Off you go.
And they won't bother investigating any further.
I don't think when Johnny Weeks died, I don't think they were like, well, he's OD'd.
Yeah.
Off you go, mate. Fine.
So that's how... I mean, that's how these people who have slipped through the cracks of society are treated. Their deaths aren't even investigated. And there's another scene in this episode where Freeman goes to missing persons to try and cross-reference with some of the bodies they're going to find in the vacants. And we get that another horrifying insight into the failings of the system where that detective tells him... you know, it's just me. We lost all our staff years
super
ago.
Super understaffed, yeah.
Yeah, I can't even keep up with the paperwork. Yeah. So it's just like, that to me was just a horrifying, like if you go missing in this city or if you're a junkie, you're basically...
Well, you're screwed. There's no one's going to know about it.
Anything can happen to you.
Unless you hear it on the streets, you don't know what's happened to someone.
Yeah. It's kind of ties in with the epigraph of this episode, which was a Bubbles line, was like, that's all there is. That all there is to it. Like, the murder, the path to murdering Bubbles' tormentor is so easy, right? The police won't investigate it. You can buy these chemicals over the counter, right? So it's like, it is incredibly easy. But what Bubbles doesn't realize is that violence and crossing that line comes with a cost, right? And Michael is paying that cost for crossing that line, which we're seeing with his soul being deteriorating. And Bubbles sadly pays the cost in a different way.
Yeah, and it was like he was showing him like he saw himself.
You're listening to Anwan Glover, who played Slim Charles.
You know, and it's like, you know, this
this kid was like running with his guys and then he got addicted. And that's another thing, the writers, they put that, and it was all about like what's really going on in Baltimore that goes on and around the world and that you can relate to. Because it happens, like it happened to me with a buddy of mine I knew that went to school, and now he's homeless and he's on drugs. But he was at his high life at one time in his life, and that was one of the guys that you would never thought that would go to use drugs. And it was like, okay, damn. And then now he's sleeping in the car. He pushing the cart. It's like, Bubbles, God damn. Well, you know, it's grooming them. So you don't want to go that way. But it's too late sometime. You know what I mean? And sometimes they get caught in that pen. But I thought that was amazing for the writers to put that in.
Listen, that whole thing with Sherrod, you know, taking the tranquilizer, thinking it was cocaine, all that fire shit, like, you know, anthrax. Like, at the end of the day, it was all playing into my favor, right? As my development, my character development, more airtime, more role time, right? Because now it's like, okay, we're trying to get this guy. We're trying to kill him. We're like, we got to do something. The police can't get him. We got to do something. So now people are like, tune the fuck in. You know what I'm saying?
Boo hiss. This is Bubbles' tormentor, played brilliantly by the actor Armando Cadogan Jr.
I loved it. I loved it. You know what I'm saying? Because the more they were trying to figure out how to end me, the more I was coming back. You get what I'm saying? And I was making it difficult for them because a lot of the things that I said was freestyle. It was improvisation. Like I improvised a lot of that with Andre. You know, I was given like two to three lines that I had to say. But the rest of that was us, you know what I'm saying? So we were very proud of that work and that chemistry. We was really like giving it all, you know? And that's what made it special because it translated well over time.
But I think let's talk about the...
I don't know what I can say about Sherrod's tragic death. Mm. It is just like, it's just a tragic accident, really. But it's a metaphorical sort of cost that Bubbles has paid for his willingness to murder.
Yeah, he's lost the kid. He's lost his ward, the person he was happy to see come back and preside over and take care and pretend he's his uncle, and give a roof over and teach him maths and you know that he's lost his kid, through his own dumb luck faults, and that's it's a. Bubbles wakes up so happy that day with like plans of scheming.
It's awful. Whenever a show spends that long on something mundane, yeah. Like, you know, you wake up and you're just like talking to somebody. It's just like, just no. Why don't we talk about something a little more upbeat?
Is it an Omar heist?
You know it. This is exactly my bag. So Omar, this is the big one though.
Yeah.
You know in heist movies when they say it's the big one? It's this the one some people come out of retirement for.
We certainly had that with Kimmy.
Yeah, Kimmy's back for the big one.
Kimmy's come out of retirement for the big one. One last score. we need you alone.
But unlike a heist movie where that heist would all go wrong and someone would and the person coming back from retirement would undeniably die or perish.
Yep.
It all goes completely according to plan.
Well, it's Omar right? Set it up.
Yeah, it's true. I like how just simple it was, right? Because we've seen Omar do not simple as well, like dress as a fucking grandmother in a wheelchair. Now they did have that. They still had their little, you know, you have to have your face doing your face person do a bit of like play acting, like Kimmy pretends to be a prostitute, right?
Yeah, that's what she's there for. She's great at doing that. She's great at play acting. That's how Omar recruited Kimmy and Tosha in you know previous episodes and previous seasons. I mean, you say it's simple, but it's still like cheese is not a stupid person, and his team is not stupid.
Yeah,
so Omar's
there's risk.
Yeah,
yeah, but it does seem like a really simple. In a way,
it does almost. I mean, like, I mean, it's not elaborate.
It's not elaborate. Yeah. Yeah. It's just like they just literally drove up and pointed a lot of guns at them and took the drugs. But what I like, to be fair to Omar, the
the elaborate part is in the build-up, the intel, mm-hmm. right? The fact that Omar got to where we've seen the build-up to this in the last few episodes.
Yeah.
And it's all by just sitting in the back of a car patiently.
Absolutely.
And watching people's movements, which Ronaldo wasn't as happy to do. You have a sense that he just got pissed off on these stakeouts. But, you know, he followed Slim Charles mm-hmm. to Prop Joe's. He followed Cheese. And it's led him to the big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, fair play to him.
One step closer to the Greek.
But he's not even Greek, is he? yeah. So, you know, he steals the stash. And a lot of people not going to be happy about it. We see a bit of Butchie as well. He helps to put the team together.
Yeah.
But great.
It is a heist. Yeah, you're kind of a heist without putting a team together.
No, exactly. Yeah.
You son of a bitch, I'm in.
Just referencing Rick and Morty there, guys. I think that's it for this episode, isn't it?
I think that's it.
Yeah. Well,
I got to say, though, my absolute... I know we talk about doing alternate epigraphs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If I were to pick an epigraph for this episode, it was Cheese's line where he's relaying the heist back to Prop Joe, and he describes it as like black ops shit, man. And he said he had this one hoe pulling guns out of her pussy, yo. And then he says that shit was unseemly, yo.
You could have played Cheese.
Unseemly. I'm getting a t-shirt that says that shit was unseemly.
I love it. I love that.
Yeah.
Never have those two words, shit and unseemly, been in the same sentence. That's the majesty of David Simon and the writing good. Stuff. Sorry, who wrote this episode? This is George Pelicanus, of course.
Oh, so good.
The author, George Pelicanus.
Hats off.
He probably gave himself the day off after writing that line.
For sure.
That shit was unseemly, yeah.
Okay, so that was it for episode 12. So next week is the season finale of season 4. It's called Final Grades. I can't believe we're actually nearly at the end. What a season. Big thank you, as always, to Sam and Martin from the brilliant Song by Song podcast. By the way, the Song by Song podcast, if you're a fan of Tom Waits and his Way Down in the Hole track from the second season of The Wire, sorry, the Sam and Martin go through all of Tom Waits's back catalog. It's a brilliant podcast. It's called Song by Song.
Yeah, and if you'd like the imagery for the season, head over to Black Snow Comics on Instagram. Thank you very much, Michael, for the image that you provided for us this season.
And thanks to Tom Wally, our chief producer, exec, honcho, and editor extraordinaire. Official titles, it's on his LinkedIn.
And thank you very much to Obi Joshua, who makes sure that this show comes to you in reasonable time and is just a genuine gentleman. He does all the transcribing using a software called Sonix. If you want to get 100 free minutes of transcription yourself using Sonix, that's Sonix, you can use the link sonix.ai/invite/stripped.
And we will see you all. Well, we won't see you. We never see you. This is a podcast. But we will. You will hear from us next week for the finale. Bye.
Bye.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.